Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Kennedy Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and today I have a very interesting episode for you, if I do say so myself. It was actually a listener request, and I thought it was really, really cool. Today's episode is going to be all about the brothers-in-laws of the Kennedy family. And I don't know if I just said that term correctly. Brothers-in-laws? Or brothers-in-law? Brothers-in-law. It would just be brothers-in-law. Okay, I'm glad that we cleared that up. Anyway, it's going to be about them. And I know I've, you know, touched on a topic of them here and there and everywhere, but we thought that we really need to have them a combined episode all together. So that's what we're going to do. Before we get to that, though, let's do our In the News segment.
Big news story of the past 7 days.
So this is pretty interesting. The British Conservative Party has released a video attacking the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, for paraphrasing President Kennedy in a speech at Labour's business conference. Of their pledge to ensure that Britain secures the highest sustained growth in the G7, Starmer said, "A target we set out, not because it is easy, I think we can dispense with that accusation, but precisely because it is hard." Which has been compared to Kennedy's moonshot speech. So if you want to learn more about that, I'll look it up. Also, I've been getting a ton of requests to cover the news. I mean, because he's obviously in it constantly, of RFK Jr. and, you know, his run for president. But guys, I just do not dabble with modern American politics on this podcast. This is just not that space. Never has been. It's a very, very bipartisan podcast. I try to keep it. And because that is such a modern hot topic, he's constantly in the news. I'm just not going to be covering news of his run. So this isn't the podcast for that, but I appreciate all the requests and everybody reaching out to me about it. But just want to clear up with you guys, I'm just not going to be covering that. All right, so let's get started. Today's sources are the JFK Library, British Heritage, People.com, BBC, The Atlantic, Independent, NBC News, Sergeant Shriver, New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, and New Yorker. I think that's all of them. Okay, so let's get started with William Cavendish, the Marquess of Hartington, and this was Kathleen Kennedy's husband. Now, I have talked about him in the past. I believe I maybe even did an episode on them together, but we're going to cover him again, you know, briefly here, just because obviously this episode is about the brothers-in-law. So he was born on December 10th of 1917, and as the son of the 10th Duke of Devonshire, he was heir to the dukedom. A title which he never assumed, though, due to his very untimely death at the age of 27. So, so young. A member of the aristocracy himself, Cavendish had links to royalties in his third cousin Diana, Princess of Wales, and his godson, Andrew Parker Bowles, Queen Camilla's ex-husband. So, I always think that's so fascinating, how royal families are all so intertwined in that way. I don't know, I need to study more about that, but I just focus so much on American history. But I should study more, because it's very interesting to me. Anyway, William was actively involved in politics. He was a member of the Conservative Party, and he contested the 1944 West Derbyshire by-election as the official candidate for the wartime coalition. However, he was defeated 41.5% to 57.7% by the independent candidate, Charles Frederick White Jr. Now, it was Kathleen Kennedy, who was JFK's favorite sister, if you remember, who married William Cavendish on May 6th, 1944, and this was 6 years after they met at a garden party in England. Now, although Kick had returned to the U.S. at the dawn of the Second World War, she returned to England as a Red Cross volunteer and reunited with her future husband. That's what I covered. Now I remember. I did a full episode on Kick, so that's why I remember covering him. Okay. If you haven't listened to that one, go back and listen to it. And as I talked about in that episode, the Kennedys did not approve of William because he was a Protestant, and that ruled out the possibility of their children being raised Catholic. So, because of this, Joe Jr. was the only member of the Kennedy family in attendance at their wedding, and Rose Kennedy wrote that she was horrified and heartbroken by the news of their nuptials. Now, very sadly, 4 weeks after Billy married Kathleen, he was called up to serve in the British Army, and their marriage was very short-lived, with Billy being killed in combat in Belgium in September of 1944. So sad and tragic. Next up, we're going to chat about Sergeant Shriver, who was married to Eunice Kennedy Shriver. And you've definitely heard a lot about him on this podcast because he worked with Kennedy quite a bit. So, and was very, very neat guy. But Robert Sergeant Shriver was born into a Catholic family in Maryland in 1915, and he was the son of a stockbroker who lost everything as a result of the Wall Street crash. Shriver was descended from German immigrants, and he spent a year in Germany at the age of 19. He subsequently attended Yale University and Yale Law School, where he was also editor of the university's Daily News. He eventually put his legal credentials to the test through his work at the law firm Winthrop Stimson and as a partner in the law firm Freed, Frank, Harris, Shriver, and Campbellman. Every time I hear names put together like that for like law firms or anything, I always think of Sterling Cooper or Draper Price, which obviously was an advertising firm in the best show ever created, Mad Men. But there's a little peek into my brain that you didn't care to hear. Let's keep going. Despite his personal opposition to American involvement in the Second World War, he served in the U.S. Navy, first as a gunner and then as a submariner. For the wounds he sustained in the Battle of Guadalcanal, he earned a Purple Heart, and when he returned home, he became assistant editor at Newsweek magazine. Sergeant Shriver met Eunice Kennedy at a dinner party in 1946, and they married in May of 1953. They had five children together, Robert III, Maria, Timothy, Mark, and Anthony. And they also had 19 grandchildren. Now, Eunice quickly introduced Sergeant to her father, who appointed him manager of the Kennedy-owned Merchandise Mart in Chicago. Now, Shriver was a very passionate advocate for civil rights, and he began directing the Catholic Interracial Council, which was an organization established for the desegregation of schools, housing, and municipal facilities in 1955. In the same year, he became the head of the Chicago Board of Education. Now, politically, Shriver was a Democrat through and through. He was a descendant of the founders of the Maryland Democratic Party. This is interesting. He considered running to be governor of Illinois, but he actually set aside his own political ambitions in order to help get President Kennedy elected by coordinating the Wisconsin and the West Virginia primaries and managing the civil rights arm of the campaign. Now, I have an episode about this as well, what I'm about to tell you, and I really like that episode. I think it's a really neat one, so go back and listen to it. He actually encouraged JFK to make the famous phone call to Martin Luther King when he was taken to jail in Alabama. And this phone call was crucial in cementing Black support for Kennedy. So go listen to that episode. It's pretty cool. Now, once Kennedy had been elected, Shriver was appointed to direct the Talent Hub Committee to research and find candidates for administrative and ambassadorial positions. He was subsequently appointed the first director of the Peace Corps, which was established in 1961, through an executive order which was signed after President Kennedy had received Shriver's report about the feasibility of a volunteer corps which would work on projects abroad.
To translate the Peace Corps idea into reality, President Kennedy chose a successful businessman who had been, up to that time, head of the Chicago Board of Education, and incidentally, a very long-time friend of mine in Chicago, Sergeant Shriver. Sergeant, how are you?
I'm fine, Dave. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm fine, too. Don't see how you're so fine and healthy-looking with the job you've done. It must have been a great drain, I should think. I remember back in the early days of the Corps, people didn't believe in it, did they?
Well, I think you're right. In the early days, Dave, a lot of people thought it was a joke. Many of the experts laughed at the ideas that American would volunteer to serve abroad for practically no money and under difficult living conditions. At that point in the Peace Corps history, we had two jobs, I thought. First, to find out whether America could still produce tough-minded, dedicated people. And second, to find out whether foreign countries really wanted the help of Americans of that type.
In the role which he held between 1961 and 1966, Shriver reviewed the work of the Peace Corps in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Germany, and established connections which formed the basis of future programs. It became the fastest-growing peacetime agency in U.S. history, and by 1966, Shriver had sent 14,500 volunteers to 55 countries. And by the time of his death, the agency had sent 200,000 volunteers to 139 countries, which is incredible. I've also done an episode on the Peace Corps. Go listen to that one, too. I need to link all of these. I'll link all of these in the description of this episode so that you guys can easily go listen. So clearly the Kennedys trusted Shriver a lot. He was even entrusted with managing President Kennedy's funeral arrangements. After the Kennedy administration, Shriver directed President Johnson's War on Poverty, the centerpiece of his visions for a great society. He launched the Office of Economic Opportunity, which introduced programs such as legal services for the poor, the Job Corps, Vista, Upward Bound, Community Action, and Head Start. However, other initiatives failed, primarily due to the redirection of funds to the Vietnam War effort. His willingness to work with Johnson was considered by some members of the Kennedy family to be a betrayal, and Bobby was reportedly behind efforts to stop him from joining the 1964 ticket as Johnson's vice president candidate, saying, "There's not going to be a Kennedy on the ticket, and if there were, it would be me." After resigning as director of the Office of Economic Opportunity in 1968, Shriver was appointed U.S. ambassador to France in 1968. During his tenure, thanks to his positive relationship with Charles de Gaulle, relations between France and the U.S., which were actually strained at the time due to de Gaulle's recognition of communist China, public denouncement of American involvement in Vietnam, and his decision to withdraw French forces from NATO's military, well, their relations improved. As ambassador, he presided over the Paris peace talks between U.S. and Vietnamese officials, and in 1969, he oversaw the first American state visit to France since 1961. Shriver served as U.S. ambassador to France until 1970, when he returned to Washington to support the Democratic Party during the midterm elections. He founded the Congressional Leadership for the Future and served as the chairman of the organization, which campaigned on behalf of Democratic candidates, with staff traveling to marginal seats in order to deliver speeches, host dinners, and participate in community events to gather support for their candidates. Now, we also have to note, of course, and there is also an episode about this, that in 1968, Eunice Kennedy Shriver founded the Special Olympics, which provides year-round training and activities to people with intellectual disabilities in 172 countries. And for over two decades, Sergeant Shriver served as president of the organization and then as chairman. Let's fast forward to 1972. Despite not being nominated at the Democratic Party convention, Sergeant Shriver was chosen to run for the vice presidency on the Democratic ticket by presidential candidate Senator George McGovern, and he replaced Senator Thomas Eagleton, whose history of depression was revealed during the campaign. But the pair were defeated by incumbent Republicans Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew, who won the biggest Electoral College landslide of the 20th century at 520-17. Side note, Shriver's bid for the vice presidency in 1972 marked the last time that a pro-life candidate was on the Democratic ticket. Shriver went on to run a short-lived and unsuccessful bid for presidency in 1976. He actually failed to win a single primary. In 1994, Shriver was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Clinton, and this was just one of several awards that Shriver won during his lifetime, in addition to 24 honorary degrees. And sadly, after an extended battle with Alzheimer's, Shriver passed away in January 2011 at the age of 95. What a resume. I mean, good Lord. Like, talk about a call to public service. Sergeant Shriver fulfilled that one. So, pretty incredible guy. Next up is Peter Lawford, who was married to Patricia Kennedy Lawford. Peter Lawford was born in London in 1923 to a family with connections to the British aristocracy. Lawford's family traveled across the world. He spent his early childhood in France, and because of his constant moving around, he was never formally educated. After meeting through JFK, Peter Lawford marries Patricia Kennedy in 1954 with 3,000 people in attendance. They had four children, but they divorced in 1965, and this is stated to be as a result of Lawford's excessive drinking and infidelity. This marked the first time a Kennedy had ever been divorced. Lawford was an actor, and he starred in his first film, Poor Old Bill, at the age of 7. Although his family had hoped that he would pursue a military career, he was prevented from doing so by a severe arm injury. He moved to Hollywood after saving money and a job parking cars in Florida, and he received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in recognition of his television work. Lawford was a member of Frank Sinatra's Rat Pack, which helped campaign for Kennedy in 1960.
In no way. That I know of. You don't want to be Secretary of Entertainment or anything like that. My job will be done, and Frank Sinatra and I, as you probably know, are doing this together, and with Roger Eden as the producer. And as soon as this is over, you know, we pack our tent and go home.
However, he was rejected by Sinatra, who blamed Lawford for the fact that President Kennedy distanced himself from him due to his alleged mob ties. And Lawford infamously introduced the Kennedys to Marilyn Monroe. Peter Lawford died in 1984 at the age of 61 of liver and kidney complications caused by substance abuse. And last but certainly not least, we've got Stephen Edward Smith, which was Jean Kennedy Smith's husband. Stephen Smith was born in Brooklyn on September 24th, 1927, and he was the youngest of five boys. Having met Jean Kennedy while studying history and social sciences at Georgetown University, the pair married in 1956 and enjoyed a 34-year-long marriage. They had four children, Stephen Jr., William, Amanda, and Kim. Now, Smith was instrumental in all three of the Kennedy brothers' presidential campaigns. He was JFK's political advisor and financial chairman, as well as Bobby and Teddy's campaign manager. Following the death of Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., Smith employed his financial experience as the chairman and CEO of Joseph P. Enterprises, Inc. This made him responsible for the Kennedy family's financial interests. As chairman of the John F. Kennedy Library Corporation, Smith oversaw fundraising for and the construction of the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. He was also the first president of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, a not-for-profit organization established to support the library's ongoing programs. In recognition of his work for the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, the newly established facilities wing was named in his honor on February 4, 1991, less than 6 months after his death on August 19, 1990. That's all I've got for you today, and I hope you learned something. I certainly did. I know that was a lot of information, but there was obviously so much more that we could have included and so much more to learn about these fascinating people. So go do your own research. I hope that this sparks a little interest in you and you want to learn more. If you have any recommendations of books to read about any of these people, I would love for you to send them my way, and I will share some of them on my Instagram as well for the rest of the listeners. If you're not following me already on Instagram, my handle is Allison L. Holland. Go follow me. You can kind of follow along with podcast stuff, and I'm a producer, so film production stuff and my life in general. I'm on the go quite a bit right now, so I hope that you'll come watch what I'm doing over there and stay up to date. If you like the podcast, please rate it 5 stars and write a positive written review. It's like tipping your waiter. It helps creators so much. I love making the show. I'm obviously doing it at no cost to you. So if you could leave me a little tip with a kind review, that is so helpful and it helps other people find the show as well. I hope you have a great week and I'll talk to you soon.
Come on and vote for Kennedy. Vote for Kennedy. Keep America strong. Kennedy, he just keeps rolling up. Kennedy, he just keeps rolling up. Kennedy, he just keeps rolling up.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.